From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 50. Yay! For Friday, the 4th of November, 2011. On this week's programme, we'll speak to Julie Lafayette, the Canadian astronaut who's alley-ooped her way into space twice as part of the International Space Station assembly missions. But what does the process of building the ISS involve? And more pressing still, how could future private space firms change the cooperative nature of spaceflight? But before that, we've got a backup Tokyo to discuss, along with synthetic blood, coin-operated breathalyzers, and creepy 3D-printed jumping robot spiders. Prepare to have your timbers well and truly shivered as we hack our way through this week's Jungle of Wired News. Ahoy to the hoy, I'm Nate Langson and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me this week is just Duncan Gear, our news editor.
Just Duncan Gear. Well, like, normally offended.
No, normally lives here and she's, you know, she's not. She's on holiday.
And so you've just got Duncan.
It's just the two of us and we can make it if we try. Liv not here this week, unfortunately, which is a real shame because this is our 50th episode, which means that we're almost to our one-year anniversary. And actually, to celebrate the fact that we've done 50 of these, although only 49 of them were ever published, we're going to give away some stuff that I found in my cupboard at the end of this show. So do listen to the end if you want to win some stuff. You'll particularly want to listen if you have an Xbox. And by the way, can you see what I'm using here, Duncan?
It looks like a MacBook Pro.
It's my brand new MacBook Pro that I bought last week.
Are you excited? You sound excited.
God, I mean, just look at it go. Look, this is like the top spec, most beautiful piece of kit I've ever...
I'm just looking at the lid from here, so I can't really see it going, but...
Most expensive thing I bought this year, but definitely the most... Anyway, let's move on, shall we? Let's do the news. Fake Mars Fakery is Fake is the title of our first story, Duncan, and it is to do with astronauts.
Yeah, that's right. Some not entirely real astronauts have come back to Earth after they faked a trip to fake Mars.
In Russia, right?
In Russia, yes, that's right. They've been spending 520 days locked inside a fake spaceship in a car park in Moscow. This is a six-man team of volunteers, and they're about to come back out.
And this was to test whether or not six men could survive in a tiny little capsule together when we eventually blast them off to Mars.
Yeah, that's right. To kind of examine the psychological aspects of what the journey would involve. They could only shower once a week, they had to eat canned food, and most interesting, there was a kind of delay on all their communications.
Hang about. So what you're saying is they lived like students for a year?
Pretty much. And there was a delay on their communications depending on how, quote, far away, unquote, they were from the Earth.
Now, the thing is, a lot of this was, as you say, to test psychological impact. But if I was locked in this, you know, giant canister showering only once a week with a bunch of other men, I would at least know that I was still in Russia.
Yeah,
that's not quite as bad as being blasted to Mars.
Yeah, absolutely. And they did actually get to go out at one point halfway through the mission. They went out onto a kind of fake Martian landscape and they had to do a little moonwalk. It was quite sweet, really.
Yeah.
It all passed out pretty much without a hitch. The lowest point was apparently back in August, which was when several of their, you know, their families and friends were on holiday, and so they didn't send so many messages. And it was also the most monotonous point of the mission. They didn't actually have very much to do, so they were just kind of sitting around.
But this is basically really good news. I mean, they were from four different nations, weren't they?
Yeah, and they got on absolutely fine. Obviously, in real space, they'd have to kind of contend with space debris, weightlessness, radiation, and, you know, all of those kind of factors, as well as the kind of psychological detachment stuff. But the capsule door, well, when we're recording this, it's gonna be open tomorrow, but by the time you hear it, it will be open. So we'll know by then if an alien jumps out.
Excellent. I mean, they will have only come from Russia.
Well, yes.
So, I mean, the worst...
Well, as far as we know.
Okay. Well, let's move on away from Russia and, not that far away, actually, down to Tokyo. There are plans in Tokyo to build, in Japan, to build a backup Tokyo. And this is essentially going to be built on about 5 square kilometers of an old airport in the event of a devastating earthquake or tsunami or another disaster that kind of threatened the political stability of Japan. They could move to this spare Tokyo that's built with casinos and bars and obviously a lot of office complexes.
So they're cloning the whole city.
No, I mean, really, it's to house, you know, political leaders and people who are going to be in charge of obviously rebuilding parts of Tokyo or Japan. But the thing is, it can house 50,000 residents, or could if it goes ahead, and it'll have of course facilities for parliament and ministries, but also like office complexes, a resort, bars, casinos. I mean, it's really a place for fun, games, and political ruling, you know, in the event of a disaster. And I find this whole thing fascinating. I mean, in a way, it makes sense. The problem is that it's only 300 miles away from Tokyo. And while that is a fair distance, if I was doing this, and I'm not, I don't mean to sort of say, Japan, you're doing it wrong, but I would put them up in like Hokkaido, which is right up at the top of Japan.
But it's also quite geologically unstable up there, isn't it? I mean, the entirety of Japan is geologically unstable, to be fair. But I mean, what they've done here is they've basically put it on the west coast rather than the east coast.
Well, I think that Japan should treat its backup cities the way I treat my backup hard drives. That is to have one under my desk at the office and one at home and then one stored in the cloud. That doesn't necessarily work in quite the same way, but the principle is the same, that you should have them so far away that whatever goes wrong with one couldn't possibly happen to the other. And I kind of think that 300 miles is still too close.
So where is this project at the moment? You said it's kind of a concept, and if it happens...
Well, for the time being, it's pretty much going to remain a concept, but it does have support from the former prime minister. And the group of people who are planning this has requested 14 million yen, which is just over £100,000, from the government to study actually how feasible this project is. But whether or not this actually happens or not is pretty much unknown.
Okay, well, we'll keep a close eye on it.
Yes, our eyes will remain very close to it. They're also going to remain fairly close to Google Street View, which has been shoving vans in shops,
Not quite vans. Google has been updating its Street View product to include the interiors of businesses that opt into its kind of interior photography program.
Okay, the thing is, Google Street View has been around for a while, and the primary use, at least as far as I'm concerned, is if you're going away somewhere you don't know, you've not been to before, you can look at the streets and you can plan a route, and it's great. Why the hell would you need to do that in a shop? Why don't you just browse their website for goods?
Well, I think you...
Explain themselves.
I didn't start the project. But no, the idea is they're going to send kind of trusted photographers into customer-facing parts of restaurants, hotels, shops, gyms, and so on, so that you can, while you're in Street View, you can just say, oh, I wonder what that looks like inside. Just pop in quickly, have a little wander around the shelves, and then come back out again.
But if I'm in a gym and I'm, you know, doing some powerful squat thrusts, you know, which obviously happens on a very regular basis, I don't want my face appearing there. I mean, I don't mind when it's on the street and I'm squat thrusting in the street. That's my fault for doing it in public, and the police will agree.
Well, I mean, your face will be blurred. They have facial blurring technology so that you can not be identified. But your squats will still be on display to all, but they won't know it's you. But I think Google's also been kind of encouraging businesses to sort of say when somebody can come around, when there isn't going to be customers in there, and take a shot of the interior without people in the way.
Okay, well, that makes a lot more sense. But I mean, I think really the end goal for this would be things like museums, you know, stuff where it's not necessarily going to change that often, and things where you can't get to see what's inside that building through any other means. I mean, you could photograph the inside of a shop, but really you could just browse that website for its goods. But a museum, that'd be far more useful.
It's a bit more interesting.
You could tie it in with other Google services, or you could tie it in with, you know, Wikipedia for photos on the wall, pictures or you know, things being displayed.
I mean, what I really like about this is it's kind of an attempt to build... You were talking before about the Tokyo clone and having a copy in the cloud. This is kind of like having a copy of the real world in the cloud, that you can just kind of wander around, and it's a virtual world copy of the real world.
I'm suddenly 9% more excited. Thanks for that. do we know when this is actually going to start rolling out?
I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I think there's a comic book store in California which already has the interior activated, and you can kind of go in and there's arrows on the shop floor so you can kind of walk around the shelves.
Cool. Blood, Duncan. Synthetic blood, specifically. This has been making the headlines.
It has. A group of biologists reckon that they're between 2 and 3 years away from the very first trials of artificial blood.
And what, for humans, right?
For humans, yeah. They've been making, from stem cells, from bone marrow cells in healthy humans, they've managed to kind of grow a material that really closely resembles the red blood cells that are naturally created in the body.
Okay, but if it's synthetic, it can't be a permanent replacement, can it?
No, this isn't exactly going to completely, you know, replace the red stuff for all situations. At the moment, we use blood in situations like surgery and when people need blood transfusions and on the battlefield and so on. Mm. And this would just be a kind of stopgap thing, temporarily for, in the worst case scenarios, before, you know, you can actually get the real stuff to somebody. They want to sort of combine it with the research into producing artificial hemoglobin, which is the protein in our blood responsible for transporting actual oxygen. And they're working to produce a particular type of blood, O negative, which is the type that 98% of us can accept.
And I guess because it's been created synthetically, there's no risk from disease.
No, exactly. HIV, hepatitis, CJD, none of those things will be in this blood. We'd know that they'd be that it would be completely clear.
So in a way, we're talking by, what, maybe 2015, having blood that could provide at least be a stopgap.
Well, almost the first trials of. I mean, we won't be seeing it on the battlefield quite then. So don't stop donating if you're a blood donor. And if you're not, then start donating. That would be the very, very, very first part of the process.
Brilliant. Well, we'll definitely keep our eye on that. Absolutely. Well, we're going to take a quick break and introduce a female voice into the midst because Liv isn't here to balance out mine and Duncan's deep man-like roars. But when we come back, Grand Theft Auto Funf.
Wired magazine, now published digitally every month on iPad. Download the latest interactive issue, available now on the iTunes App Store.
Grand Theft Auto 5, Duncan.
Yes.
It has been confirmed and will probably be out next year. On a scale of 1 to 5, how grand is your will for this theft?
Probably about Vice City levels, I think.
This has broken down entirely. Are you excited about this?
I am excited about this. This is GTA 5. You've probably heard of GTA. It's been blamed for murders and, you know, prostitutes and all kinds of things. But it is a video game made by a company called Rockstar, who are based in Scotland.
And Scotland is not going to be the location for the city that we're going around. They've gone back to an old city again.
That's right. The first trailer has just been announced, and it shows this kind of collage of what is basically the versions in the game of Los Angeles, which is Los Santos, and various other parts of the state, San Andreas, which is kind of the GTA analog of California.
Why would you not, if you're going to do this and you've already got several cities in the bag, why would you not go and do something in a really cool new city?
Well, that's what they did with Vice City, and it was brilliant, and it's what they did way back when they did GTA London.
But that was
a long time ago.
Wasn't that an expansion pack?
Yeah, sort of. I think it was a kind of expand-alone sort of thing. But I mean, that was brilliant, and you kind of got to be transported to a kind of different time as well as a different place. Obviously, Vice City was set in the kind of 80s, and GTA London was in the 60s, and yeah, it was a fantastic experience. I'm a little bit disappointed that we're back in Los Santos.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
it's all right and everything, but
you could do something great in Russia or Italy.
I'd love to see one in like a kind of GTA version of Washington with a kind of Washington DC with a kind of really deep political subplot. I think that could be incredibly interesting. A bit like The Wire.
I've never seen The Wire.
You should. It's very good.
Okay. Or Paris.
Or Paris.
So I'm just naming cities here that I'd like to have a Grand Theft Auto. If you people
or Bristol,
send in some ideas. podcast@wired.co.uk.
Where would you like to see GTA set in the future?
Yeah, I'm thinking now things like Antarctica, you know,
penguin.
It might change the theme of the game.
Things. And yeah, no, like, definitely. We don't know enormously much about it yet. We just know that it's going to be in San Andreas. We don't know when it's going to be out. We don't know what platforms it will be released on. But I would be very, very surprised if it wasn't going to be out on the Xbox 360 and PS3. And it wasn't going to be out in 2012.
We do. Oh, what? Not next year? Are you kidding? Of course it's going to be out next year.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was out in 2012.
Ah, yeah. I reckon probably October next year.
October. That's your bet. I will go September.
Okay. Interesting.
We'll see who's right.
Maybe on episode 100 we will know for sure.
Yeah.
Let's move on then and talk about a coin-operated breathalyzer, which I found to be a fascinating idea. If you could shove a breathalyzer machine on the wall of a pub, pay a pound and see how drunk you are. It's both fun and potentially life-saving. Tell me more.
This is the a company called AlcoSense, which has released a product called the WM1. They sell lots of kind of like handheld breathalyzer equipment. But this is one that's kind of mounted on the wall of a pub or a bar or an airport, I don't know, wherever. And the idea is you put in a quid and you blow into a straw, and about 5-10 seconds later, your blood alcohol content gets displayed between 0% and 5%. And 5% is obviously six times the legal limit. So
The cool thing about this is that obviously it's designed to be used to prevent drink driving accidents and for people to realize how much they've drunk. But you made a good point before we started recording that this really could be some kind of a, you know, competition.
Yeah.
Like, who is the most drunk?
Who can hit 5% first? It's it could be a little bit dangerous in that regard. But at the same time, you know, it's also a nice idea so that people can, you know, see exactly whether they are safe to drive back or not. Or, you know, a partner could say, I want you to go over to the machine and see whether you're safe before we go, or something like that.
They should definitely put it next to the kind of the slot machines and the gambling things and the deal or no deal, you know, Noel Edmonds machines.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? The gambling thing. And it'd be the same. Machine. Like, you know, if you're drunk, you win a fish or something.
Yeah,
or
absolutely.
Another beer.
But if you want to buy one, they come in two variants. There's one with a kind of 7-inch LCD screen that can display ads, and one without. The one that does have it costs £700. The other one costs £600. And the manufacturers reckon that if you put it up in your bar or whatever, it will generate about £35 a week per 1,000 people, which seems quite a lot.
Bar owners, get on it. Although really, if you think about it, this should be government subsidized to convince bar owners to put it in.
Well, yeah, I can see the problem when it comes to people challenging themselves to hit it.
Well, you know, it's making money, it's a pound, and it's helping save lives. I mean, that's got to be the best kind of game, surely.
Ideally, yeah.
It's both fun and helpful. Well, anyway, let's talk about something that is entirely unhelpful. Today, Lomo, which is the company that makes those kind of little plastic cameras for hipsters, they have released their first Duncan's grin. He hates me calling them hipsters. It's true though, isn't it?
Well, sort of, yeah. Carry on.
I mean, I like them, don't get me wrong. I actually do like the cameras, but they are...
They're nice cameras. I like them more when they were... We're digressing a bit here, but sure. I like them more when they were doing kind of interesting things. There used to be one called, I think it's the Octomat, which would take 8 photos on the size of a regular photo,
yeah.
And it would kind of expose over time. And that was interesting, but I don't like it where they just kind of just put a filter on it. You know,
yeah.
It's just Instagram, and that's a little bit boring.
Instagram and Hipstamatic really stem from this, which is these cameras are designed, now at least, to take kind of poor quality pictures that have certain distortions and effects caused by the hardware that actually gives them a really pleasing result.
Yeah, a sort of aesthetic quality.
Exactly. And the fun thing is that they still use 35mm film, and they've now made a video camera version, which finally is now the news.
Yeah.
And it's called the Lomo Kino. It uses 35mm film. It can record only 144 frames per 35mm film, which costs about, what, $350, something like that.
Something like that.
And the unit costs £60, and you have to use a handle. So it's kind of like...
You crank it on the side. It's,
yeah.
I was playing with it earlier, and it's very, very odd to use.
Yeah, we got one sent in. There's a launch party this evening that I'm probably going to end up being late to now. but yeah, they sent one in, and it does look kind of cool, but it's got that Lomo feel where it's kind of crappy plastic, but it's still got that really cool effect that a lot of people still want to use.
Yeah.
It just strikes me as pointless because it's 140 frames... And it costs a fortune to do. There's no sound. Who's this for? Tell me this isn't for the world's hipsters.
Well, it kind of is. I mean, they on the back plate, it declares that it's gloriously analog. So it's kind of for the technophobes, maybe. But it's a nice little bit of kit. It's fun. It's fun to play around with. It's not really particularly serious.
That's the bottom line, is that it is fun. That one of the reasons Hipstamatic and those sort of apps are so popular is because they do add an element of fun to photography, and I think that's really all this is for.
If you're after kind of specs and, you know, megapixels and things like that, stay far away.
Yeah. Out now?
I don't know.
Don't know. We're not paid to talk about it, so let's let other people find out. It's out at some point. Last story before we get onto our feature this week is that a giant jumping robot spider has been 3D printed and is going to... what's it going to do?
Well, it's not that giant. It's going to skitter around where humans can't, which is a terrifying concept if ever I've heard one.
So what's old 3D printed spidey legs going to do? What's the point of this? In fact, what is it? Start from the top. What is it?
Okay, so this is some roboticists from a German research group who've used 3D printers to kind of create the bits of a spider-like robot which can jump and climb over hurdles and so on and so forth.
bit like Big Dog.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, the difference between this and Big Dog is that it kind of walks around like a real arachnid. It has four legs on the ground at any one time, which is very stable, and then it can use the other four to kind of ready themselves for the next step. So it puts four legs down while the others move into place, and then it puts them down, and so on. It's very, very sturdy.
So good for, like, industrial accidents where chemicals might have been spilled, and we need to, for some reason, send a robot over.
Yes.
And maybe get a sample or something. I don't
know. Wouldn't be able to go on wheels or something like that, or caterpillar tracks. Some of the models can even jump into the air. There's a kind of bellow drives in the robot's legs, and by shooting fluid very quickly into the limbs, they can jolt the legs such that it propels it upwards in a particular direction.
That's amazing. But I think the really cool thing about this is that it's another example of something useful being done with 3D printed technology, because this is all 3D printed, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the best bit about it, because they can make a few little tweaks to an algorithm that generates the parts, and then sort of alter the end result. So if you want to just, you know, load it up with more stuff, more sensors, more cameras and so on, you just load that into the algorithm and it will generate one with a higher load-bearing ability that might be a little bit bigger as a result, but it's infinitely variable.
I love the idea of sort of sending a van to the scene of some sort of a, you know, an accident in a building maybe, and you've got a kind of, in the same way that fire engines and fire trucks have water cannons and things installed, you have a 3D printer installed, and like, oh, we're going to need a, you know, a Class D robot spider. You press the button, it 3D prints, and you throw it into the building, and it sort of use once and destroy. I kind of like that.
Well, yeah, that's the scary bit to me. Ralph Becker, who was one of the researchers behind it, said our robot is so cheap to produce that it can be discarded after being used just once, like a disposable rubber glove. That terrifies me that somewhere there's going to be this colony of discarded spider bots that are going to be seeking revenge on humanity.
Well, they'd be recycled, wouldn't they?
Well,
you know, like ordinary spiders.
I hope they're going to be recycled. I'm terrified by the whole process.
Well, we are going to leave the news behind on that arachneal note. Is that a term?
It is now.
Okay. And we're going to move into our astronomical feature. So, Duncan, you spoke to an astronaut this week.
I did. Julie Lafayette, a Canadian astronaut who has been into space twice to help put the ISS together. Once right at the start when it was first being constructed, and once much more recently, in 2009, to conduct some more work. And I was really interested in kind of speaking to her to find out a little bit more about how the ISS gets put together, for one thing, and also about how private companies becoming increasingly involved in spaceflight could change the kind of diplomatic, cooperative atmosphere that surrounds spaceflight.
I think it's time to find out.
I'm here with Julie Payette, and she's been into space twice, is that right?
Correct, both on the space shuttle in 1999 and 2009.
What kind of aspects of the International Space Station were you putting together? What bits were you constructing?
On my first flight in 1999, we were the second shuttle and the second crew ever to go to the International Space Station. At the time, it was made of two modules, a American module and a Russian module that had been put together in space just a few months before we arrived, and it was completely empty. There was nobody on board, and it was not outfitted. So we brought in Discovery full loaded with equipment to outfit the station outside and inside. And we transferred all that equipment and performed one spacewalk during that mission, which lasted 10 days. My second mission was completely different. It was 10 years later in 2009. And by then, the station was almost complete. We had a cargo bay full of last pieces of equipment that were required, including a scientific platform to be installed at the tip of the Japanese module, which was already there. We had spare parts, which were to be installed on a storage platform on the space station in case something would fail when the shuttle is not there. And it did after we left. A pump failed, and they used one of the spare pumps we had brought in. And we also changed the six batteries of the port side of the station, batteries that are used to store the energy that we take out of the sun rays by our solar panels, and it stores its energy into the batteries to continuously supply the space station with electrical power.
What was it like being one of the first people to be on the International Space Station?
It was a really cool mission and a very, very fun job to do. We arrived and the place was pristine. We had to open a lot of the compartments which had been sealed for launch. You know, part of the job was to open things up. I was setting up the tent. It was It was a lot of fun. We were really setting up, and then two more missions came after us to set up what was needed for the first permanent crew.
And then returning 10 years later, what was it like kind of coming back? Was it a very different experience?
Well, clearly the first time we opened, we switched on the lights and floated inside a completely empty and pristine environment. The second time, the door was opened by one of the six crew members that were on board. So the laboratory was fully functional at the time of my second flight, and the astronauts that were on board were living there for periods of 6 months at a time. So it was I was a lived-in laboratory as opposed to an empty one.
And having left the Earth, what's it like coming back?
Physiologically, we have to readapt to gravity. Usually takes a few days. If you've spent several months in space, then you're at a readaptation to gravity, especially in terms of retraining your muscles to walk and recalcifying somehow your bones. That takes a little longer. We have equilibrium issues as well because of the fact that the inner ear, our equilibrium system, shuts down or stops sending data to the brain, or the brain stops listening to the data of the inner ear. I don't know exactly which one is which, but one thing is sure is that it's not being utilized, and when you get back on under a gravity environment, it has to retrain itself. Again, a few days. It's an interesting time. You feel a little wobbly on your legs, but otherwise, most of the time, it's a very, very joyous occasion because it's at the conclusion of a mission.
I understand that one of your kind of specialisms is the diplomatic aspect of space.
Well, I did some research that concluded in the fact that big projects, big collaborative projects like the International Space Station have a lot of benefits back here on Earth. And one of the perhaps major benefit is the fact that by working together, we learn a lot about each other, and we tend to get along better. And it sounds a little simple and cliche, but the International Space Station is run by over three continents, by five different space agencies, and it's being run 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, and we rarely hear about it in the media. Because things are running well, because operations are smooth, because people are getting along, nobody's killing each other, nobody's threatening each other, and even though part of the station is controlled directly by Mission Control Moscow, and the other part is directly controlled by Mission Control Houston in Texas, when there is issue, people talk and solve them. And there are issues, but they're just being solved as opposed to being turned into a conflict.
How do you see the kind of the future of space flight in terms of the diplomatic aspects? Is it going to continue to be cooperative, or do you think the rise of other countries like China and India and their space flight ambitions, do you think that's likely to throw a spanner into the works?
I don't have a crystal ball, but I would say that physics is not... is the friend of teamwork and collaboration, because when you're in orbit of the Earth, you are turning around all the time. You can't stop and say, okay, well, this little piece of space is going to be mine, and you can have this little piece of space. Well, it's a much more complicated matter than that. So it almost cries for working together, for teamwork. The other aspect is the fact that it is complicated and it is risky business to go and fight gravity and get into orbit and then even go further than that, which we don't at right now. And we do this better with all our resources and all our brains together than we do by ourselves. So I would suspect that eventually, yes, we'll collaborate a little bit better, and that's the way it should be.
And do you think there will be an effect from the increasing reliance on commercial spaceflight companies to get astronauts into space? Do you think that will have an effect on international cooperation?
100 years ago, when the first aviators were flying aeroplanes, nobody foresaw, but it happened pretty quickly, that companies started making airplanes, and then they started making passenger airplanes, and now we all fly, and we don't even think a second thought about it. Things are not going to happen this fast or this quickly for space, because also we don't have a destination, particularly right now, as opposed to on Earth, we always have a place to go. but it will provide. It makes a lot of sense for commercial companies to take over some of the tasks to be done and run a company and make profit out of this. And carrying cargo to the International Space Station, which is currently the only destination we have in space, other than unmanned satellites.
And then finally, if there's any kind of wannabe astronauts who are listening to our podcast, do you have any specific points of advice for becoming an astronaut right now?
Well, to become a government astronaut, that is an astronaut that is recruited by a government space agency. There are not many recruitment programs, but they are looking for people with a technical background, people who are in good shape, can communicate, and have demonstrated involvement in their community and are good team workers. There will be, however, in the next few years, a possibility to buy tickets to go on a suborbital flight in particular. Eventually, people hope to send passengers to orbital flight. These tickets are a lot more affordable right now than they were a few years ago, so people will become astronauts by having the amazing privilege of seeing the Earth from above, or without being the pilot or the operator of the spacecraft. And that's, again, totally normal evolution of things.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the studio, Duncan.
Thank you. She was a lovely person.
Before we get to our competition, we've got a bit of feedback to read out. We don't normally read out all our feedback because a lot of the time it's questions for products and things like that. But we had a couple of very sweet emails this week. Duncan, why don't you take the first one?
Yeah, Denise Jose Francois. I've kind of probably over-egged the pudding on the pronunciation there a little bit. But they said, "Hey guys, love the podcast. How about letting us know what kind of hardware you use? Are you in a proper studio or sitting around somebody's dinner table or in a cupboard somewhere deep in the Condé Nast monolith? Do you use the latest pro gear or is it all done on an iPad?"
It's a good question. It's not actually the first time I've been asked. People have asked this over Twitter.
Yeah, we don't really use a proper studio. We're kind of around a dining table, but it's in a cupboard deep in the Condé Nast monolith. Well, not monolith, polymath.
It's in one of our rooms on Bond Street, but we do use proper studio gear, mixing desks, which is made by Behringer, and we use Behringer mics as well. We record on a MacBook Pro. And what else do we use?
Well, I've been waving around my iPad, which I use to kind of keep track of the stories. We kind of work out what stories we're going to use in advance and then kind of make some notes about them and then talk from those.
But thanks, Denise. Also, we've had another email, a very sweet email from Thekla Knieson. I hope I pronounced your name right. Many apologies if I haven't. I would just like to say I adore your podcast. I cut out a little bit because I didn't want to seem like we're self-aggrandizing here. But thank you so much for being awesome and amazing. Please continue making the podcast. I would just like to say right here and now in episode 50, almost 1 year into our broadcasting, we will be continuing the podcast.
Definitely.
And thank you for your lovely email. If you want to send us some email, you can email us podcast@wired.co.uk. And we've got a Twitter feed.
We are.
@wired.uk. And Duncan, what's that Facebook page?
Facebook. You can go to facebook.com/wiredUK. But before you email us about feedback, tell us exciting things, we've got a competition for you.
We have. I decided to... I have a big cupboard behind my desk and it's full of really cool stuff that we get sent and never do anything with or it just gets lost. So I've decided to start giving some stuff away. So we'll call this Stuff from Nate's Cupboard Competition. This week, we're going to give away a 12-month subscription to Xbox Live Gold. Because why not?
Yeah.
So drop us an email if you want it, podcast@wired.co.uk, and tell us what you think will be the hot topic we'll be discussing on episode 100.
In another 50 weeks' time.
Yeah, we'll put all the winners all the submissions into a little basket and make a little short list of the ones we find most interesting.
Make a little nest and sit in it for a while
maybe.
And then pick one.
And then we'll pick a winner for next week. So drop us a line. What are we going to be talking about on episode 100, maybe? podcast@wired.co.uk, and that's where you can send us email as well. And I think on that note, we will see you next week.
Goodbye.
From London, it's the wired.co.uk pod... That was a bit lame.
I like that.
No, I sounded a bit, I don't know, like a horse had been taught how to speak. You know, lips got in the way of his words.